1st. This is very exciting. We have a number of measures. Just to let you know, the plan for the day, we are going to move forward, assuming we get the votes, on House Bill 2762. I'd like to have a discussion about 2640. There's some issues regarding electioneering, and I think there's some folks here that can help us with that conversation. We have two bills that we will only do public hearings on, Senate Bill 1051 and Senate Bill 1052. My understanding is there's an amendment that we need on Senate Bill 1052. We'd like to bring those both back pretty quickly early next week to get them moving over to the House. With that, Senator George, I'm assuming you're here on Senate Bill 1051. Why don't we open a public hearing on that? Come on forward. And then we'll probably move to 1052 because we want to get the judicial branch out of this building as quickly as possible. In more ways than one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. State Senator Gary George representing District 12. There are a lot of us around that love things that go boom in the night.
Yes.
And this is a bill about that. Now, as you know, this issue has been around for quite a long time.
Yes.
And as a farmer and as a person who had an explosives magazine in the past, we didn't really know what it was when we bought the land, only to find myself looking at dynamite and realizing that the nitroglycerin was leaking out of that. Thank goodness, because it was a rural area, we were able to accommodate the disposal of that product. What happened, though, a couple of years ago on the witness subject, is we had the person that owns the largest magazine in Oregon in one of the hearings, and he made a statement I think is very relative to this bill. And what he said was is that at that time we had a few incidents in which fire marshal was going in on magazines that they believed were illegal and cutting the locks off the doors and scaring a lot of people half to death with that. And thank goodness we changed our tactics and we're doing a lot better job in managing that. But the person that had the largest explosive magazine was in Eugene. And he said in testimony that his wife, he was telling his wife about the story and said, you know, honey, if they ever come here and they take a torch and begin to cut the locks off of our magazine, you and I are jumping in the car and we're heading to the coast because you don't want to see an explosion that big. So what we're talking about here is the possibility of having these magazines located in farm areas, and as you can tell, if you go to page 6 of the bill, you'll see that that's very tightly defined, and it is not on high-value farmland, and that the person that is owning and operating the magazine has other uses of the property on lines 34 and 35. My personal view is this is where these belong. We store a lot of things in agricultural areas because you don't want them near a city. We operate certain kinds of businesses out in the rural area because you don't want those near a city or population. And because many times what we're talking about is that isolation gives the opportunity for the securing of that lockup. So with that, I hope you will consider the testimony. A lot of work has been done on this bill, and a substantial agreement has been reached. I think we have a chance of actually passing something that will be beneficial for Oregonians as far as safety and as far as fairness in the business climate. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Senator George? Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1051, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1052. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us a little bit about it? Judge Lipscomb, why don't you bring two of your colleagues up? We'd like to get Mr. Biglaw back prosecuting criminals as quickly as possible as well. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1052 provides for increased non-waivable unitary assessment in meth-related crimes, directs that those proceeds of additional assessment be transferred to counties for administration of substance abuse treatment programs.
Thank you. And for the colleagues, for the record, this is Senator Winner's bill, and she could not be here today, but I wanted to move forward on the hearing just out of courtesy to her. So welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to begin by pointing out that at least our local judiciary has a long and pleasant history in this building, particularly during the last session.
We enjoyed your tenancy very much. I thought the rent was a little low, however. Oh, and then I need you to state your name for the record.
Paul Lipscomb, Marion County Circuit Court. I'm the presenter. We're here on behalf of Senate Bill 1052. I think anyone who works in the criminal justice system today recognizes that the biggest remaining gap, the biggest hole, if you will, in the system is money for drug treatment. This bill is at least a start towards filling part of that gap, and we certainly would encourage you to endorse this idea and any other ideas that would lead to funding provided to, particularly at the local level, but funding provided for drug treatment for the people in our community who suffer the most direct effects of the scourge of drugs, recognizing, of course, that all of us suffer in one way or another from what the devastation that drugs cause in our community, and methamphetamine in particular. With me today is Walt Beglow, our district attorney, and Judge Dennis Graves, who's our drug court judge here in Marion County. But I think it's fair to say that everyone involved in at least our local criminal justice community, and I think this is true throughout the state, supports money for additional funds for drug treatment. And I would certainly encourage you folks to take this opportunity to begin the task of assisting the local communities in meeting those needs.
Thank you. Judge, did you want to add anything?
Sure. I run the adult drug court judge, drug court program here. We have two other drug courts as well, a juvenile drug court and a family attachment court. I can tell you that we have 50 participants in our adult drug court. That's all we have in the way of money for treatment. We could have more people in that program if we had more money. I can tell you that we focus in partnership with our district attorney's office on helping families that have drug-endangered children. That is, they were arrested on a drug charge. They had children in the home. The children were removed by DHS and placed in foster care. So those are the participants that we have in our program. We have a liaison with DHS who has a designated child welfare worker who works on our team. We also have a significant need for mental health treatment for those individuals because many of them have co-occurring disorders. Mm-hmm. I think I speak for all the drug court judges throughout the state in saying that the need is great. We think the method of helping our people recover in drug courts is effective and proven effective, and we could use more so that we could help more.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify, Judge Graves, that the juvenile drug court, is that for the delinquency side?
It is.
And the family attachment, I assume that tied in with DHS and the foster care and the dependency side?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Beglow.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Walt Beglaw, and I'm the Marion County District Attorney. I'm here on behalf of the Blue Ribbon Task Force and my community. That was chaired and is chaired by the Honorable Senator Winters and Senator Courtney. Here to express my support for Senate Bill 1052, and it really represents one simple premise. And that premise is that those who deliver, drug dealers, those who manufacture, and not just taxpayers, should shoulder the cost of the misery that the drug that they're delivering into our communities accounts for. As the judges have mentioned here, in the face of this gripping addiction that we're seeing, every community in Oregon is leaning in to address those issues with programs and the valuable treatment component that is necessary in the public safety system. And it's around drug treatment programs for adults and kids alike. And in our county, we're focused, we brought even our business community and our local community to address that. And we're learning just a couple things that I've mentioned. One, that treating meth addiction is terribly difficult. It's enduring, but it clearly can be accomplished. And secondly, as the judge has said, there's simply not enough resources. And it's not an overstatement to say that lives are at stake when it comes to the decision about providing treatment within these programs. On more than one occasion, I have sat and been part of a decision where we did not have adequate resource, nor did that particular individual, and they were not eligible for that wraparound accountable programs our counties are delivering, and they fall off the face of the earth. And if they don't die, they enter the system again through the criminal justice system prosecuted by me. So this would create a funding stream for those who choose to deliver and manufacture meth. It's behavior-based. We've made that pretty clear line, not for those who possess methamphetamine. It's those who make that choice to deliver or make it in our communities. The dollars would be delivered on a local level, which is extremely important because then we can tailor that resource to the community itself. And each community, obviously, is quite different. And because of the allocation tiers within this bill, it was written pretty darn well, and I give credit to them for that. It won't diminish or compromise the allocation of other resources for restitution. I have to tell you, in delivery and manufacturing cases, there isn't any restitution on this case. The state, so to speak, is the victim of that. And so in a way, this is a way to capture restitution for the damage that an individual who's delivering meth in our communities can take. So been a little bit of comment about, well, should it be waivable or not? It's designed. I think this is a very narrowly designed for meth delivery and manufacture. This is a compelling issue, and we do have some precedents in other statutes where we have made the fine or assessments around treatment. Furnishing alcohol is one where the court doesn't have the discretion and impose it because of that compelling community issue. And I think this is one of the times to do that. I always honor court discretion when they're making difficult choices at sentencing, but I think this is one of those times where we want to send a community message around, you're going to pay for the damage you're doing, and it's going to go into treatment. So with that, I appreciate your time and consideration of this bill, and I do appreciate Senator Winters. I've talked with her, and I'm very pleased to bring this forward on her community's behalf as well.
Thank you. Judge Lipscomb, can you address the discretion issue? I know the legislature in the last 15 years has worked really hard to make sure that you have none, so I just want to make sure.
I thank you for the opportunity, Senator Brown. I don't want to be the first judge appearing in this building speaking out against judicial discretion. I think when it comes to judicial discretion, much like money for drug treatment, more is better than less. And I would hate to see judicial discretion eroded, speaking generally, eroded any further than it already has been, which at least in my view, personal view, has been somewhat unfortunate. But having said that, I really don't have anything more to say on this topic today. Thank you very much.
Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. I really appreciate you joining us this afternoon, and we'll let you get back to the business of enforcing and I would say creating the laws, but we're doing that here, or at least trying to. So
thank you.
We're going to finish off the public hearing on Senate Bill 1052, at least in terms of folks that have signed up. Nancy Cosine and Ann Christian, why don't you guys come on out? Is there anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1052? And we're not going to move this bill today. There's an issue with at least one amendment and possibly two. So, and I want to make sure Senator Winters is okay with the product that we move forward on. Take it away, Nancy.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm here to simply explain the -1 amendment. Senator Winters was kind enough to submit that for us. This amendment simply allows the Judicial Department to make the technological changes necessary to implement the new assessment.
Can you talk into the...
My name is Nancy Cosine. I'm the Criminal Law Staff Counsel for the Oregon Judicial Department. The -1 amendments would do two things. They would remove the emergency clause from Section 6 and amend Section 5 by changing the date to which the amendments would apply to crimes committed on or after the effective date of the Act. We have an antiquated computer system at the Judicial Department. You've probably heard.
We're working to fix that.
I won't go into great length on that issue, but as it currently stands, we need about 30 to 60 days to do the computer programming, which includes the development, reprogramming, and testing, and then another 60 days to roll it out across the state and have it installed and trained for each individual county court. So, circuit court. So, if there are any questions, I'm available. We ask you to adopt those amendments so we can get the system going.
Ann.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Christian, and I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Our association couldn't agree more that the biggest gap in the criminal justice system today is the money for drug treatment. That's been an issue for decades, in fact, but it did get to a critical level. And so I want to make it clear that Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers made it one of its highest priorities this session for increased money for drug treatment and methods to support improvements and increases in drug treatment. So generally, I should be here in support of this bill, and we are in support of the notion of getting more money for drug treatment. I think there are four policy issues within this bill that at least we want to raise with this committee, because after all, it is your final decision. The first would be increasing the amount of the unitary assessment for methamphetamine delivery and manufacturing cases as opposed to other felonies being rape or other drug offenses. The current unitary assessment for a felony case in general, generic, is $107, and the proposal here is to increase the amounts. We are not taking a position as far as whether or not that's good or bad to start carving out individual crimes, but we think that that's the first of four policy issues. The second is whether or not...
Question? Can you let her finish?
Yes, thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sorry.
The second would be whether or not the intent is to include juveniles within this bill. I think that's something to consider. There are a few crimes where there's an express provision that the law does not apply to juveniles, and we're just thinking that for someone under 18, the increase of a $500 or $1,000 unitary assessment may be less realistic than even for an adult. So the second issue, policy issue, is whether it should apply to juveniles. The third of the four issues is whether or not these mandatory assessments for any person who is convicted of delivery of a controlled substance should apply to the individual who is not who you and I would think of as a drug dealer. So in other words, a person who possesses methamphetamine and who delivers it to, say, one individual, a friend. Or are we talking, as a policy matter, wanting to, as I think the district attorney testified, have the drug dealers that we think of as drug dealers shoulder the cost of treatment? And I suggest that OCDLA would be more comfortable if the target population were made what we typically think of drug dealers. So one thing I was thinking of, and I've talked with a few people about, is there under current law is a provision for an individual who is charged with delivery or manufacture of a controlled substance to receive an enhanced sentence based upon two things, two options: the substantial quantity of the drug that's involved in the delivery, as opposed to me delivering to a friend, a substantial quantity, or a commercial drug offense where there's lots of money involved and other factors where it's clear that this individual indeed is what we commonly think of as a drug dealer. So that's the third issue that we would raise as a concern. And the final, and this is the one that I think our members have the greatest concern about, is the judicial discretion, as Madam Chair, you raised. It has been, again, decades that judicial discretion has been eroded, and I just find it of concern that, and OCDLA does as well, that we're at the point with drug treatment not being adequately funded, that we would think that taking away judicial discretion would be the best way to remedy that situation. And it may not seem like a big deal to take away this judicial discretion, since judges have lost discretion almost over everything. But I would just assert that, especially for this population, where you do have mothers, fathers who have lost their children to abuse, and people in the criminal justice system, that every dollar that they have available, say in Judge Graves' drug court, ought to go directly to their personal treatment as opposed to a mandatory unitary assessment of $500 or $1,000. So those are the four policy issues that we have concerns about. I want to make it absolutely clear that Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers supports almost every single effort to get more drug treatment money, because we have seen for decades the cycling and cycling of people and the damage that's occurring to them and their families. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne. Appreciate your comments. Questions? Senator Montes Anderson.
When you say that for an ordinary felony it's $107, and then in the bill, because it doesn't say, I assume that the $500 would be in lieu of the $107. Is that what it means? And then what is the $1,000 in lieu of?
Madam Chair and Senator Montes Anderson, I would read this, that the proposed new $500 mandatory unitary assessment, and as well as the $1,000 mandatory, both are in lieu of the $107. And I should correct myself, because there already is an exception for felonies, and that under current law is a $500 unitary assessment for a criminal conviction under what's called Chapter 163, which would be what people call person offenses. So the sexual offenses, assaults, that type of crime. The difference, however, is the $500 unitary assessment under current law for those person crimes is waivable. I mean, when we say waivable, what we mean is that the individual is before the judge, and the judge is able to take into consideration that particular person's individual financial situation. It doesn't mean the entire unitary assessment will be waived. It means that part of it could be waived.
And you're saying, just follow up, you're saying that this bill then would not, would allow no discretion from the judge.
Madam Chair and Senator Montes Anderson, that's my reading of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, we're separating out meth here, but that was the intention last session when we were redefining things, was to separate meth out as a separate entity unto itself rather than just other drug crimes. So your objection isn't to that particular.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, I raised that not as an objection, but as a policy issue, whether you want to continue that. You are correct. You made that policy decision last session.
I guess since we're not going to move this, particularly with Senator Wieners, I'd really encourage you, Anne, to step out and talk with the good district attorney to address a couple of the issues. Just sort of my thoughts on hearing this, and I appreciate the concerns you're raising. I can't tell from the way it's written in the language on lines 9 and 10 about whether it includes juveniles. And I don't know if that was the 10. I would not be likely to include juveniles in this. In terms of sort of separating out this crime, I think it makes sense to do that given the circumstances that we're dealing with. So, sorry, you've been working with you got someone here who knows what the impacts are. Right. The third piece, substantial quantity, I think you raised good points there. I would be happy to hear from the committee members over the next 48 hours on that issue. In terms of judicial discretion, I guess given if this is broader in terms of who it impacts, I'm inclined to give the judges discretion. Mm-hmm. If it's narrower, i.e. focused on either quantity and commercial drug offense, I'm inclined to give the judges less discretion. So that's just the direction I would go in. Happy to hear input as we work through this, yeah. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I think I'd agree. I'd like to know what I mean, because we don't have that many cookhouses left in the state, and hopefully they continue to not exist. But so we're dealing more with delivery and what is considered. I mean, there's got to be some structure in there. I mean, I think you're right. If somebody had, they were taking some to a friend. That's almost like in the use statute, and not in they aren't in the business commercially at that point. So I mean, clearly, if there's an ounce, that's a lot. But clearly, between a quarter gram and an ounce, there's got to be some line in there that people would tip, I would think.
Sir Ferrielli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're certainly aware the Blue Ribbon Task Force brought the request for this bill.
Madam Chair and Senator Ferrioli, absolutely I am.
What was the interface between either of your organizations and the folks working on the task force?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, unfortunately I'm not aware that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, and I hope I'm right, had a representative on that Blue Ribbon Task Force.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if there wasn't a representative on the task force, you were aware that it was up and operating.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Ferrioli, unfortunately I was not. And I apologize. I apologize to
apologies are not necessarily
not with OCLA in this role during the interim. So
we have, Madam Chair, we've got cases on record where parents were using their children to deliver the substance. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm going to offer a little pushback on this. Compassion is a great thing, and I think that is the driving force behind the drug courts to try to get people into treatment and change behaviors and give them the time they need to make the recovery possible. But there's got to be a pretty clear message sent that this is not a victimless crime. Society is, in real difficulty here, and the unitary assessment, I think, helps in that regard. So I guess I suppose I'm telegraphing my strong support for this kind of an approach. And I'm not so sure that juveniles, even though they are assumed to lack capacity to pay a unitary assessment, aren't the very ones that we ought to be reaching first and earliest with the message that if you do this substance and this crime, it's expensive, mentally, physically, to the community, and financially as well.
Mr. Senator Ferrioli, and I don't know that you necessarily need to respond unless you really want to. I think the committee clearly wants to move forward on this legislation. I think, and I don't think Ann is saying that at all. I think the devil is in the details. And my experience, limited experience in the dependency system, is our great lack of drug treatment, both inpatient and outpatient, and I think this is a statewide problem. But for those of us who've worked in the system, one of the issues very clearly is one of the issues for the folks who are needing treatment is that they have to, if they're not eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, and very few folks are, then they have to come up with the dollars to pay for their own treatment. And so if they're paying off a unitary assessment fee of $700 or $800, which the total impact could be as I look through the numbers, I don't know how they can actually pay for their treatment. So they don't have the resources to pay either the fine or for the treatment. So we're back to square one, and that is, frankly, we don't simply have enough treatment beds. So I don't think they're opposed to the bill. I think it's kind of how we deal with it, and I think she raises some issues that are definitely legitimate. And so, anyway, I'm going to let you guys go unless there's any more questions. Go beat it out in the hallways. And Nancy, did you want to say anything? And
I just wanted to offer one point of clarification in case I misheard, but I believe that both unitary assessments would be imposed in these type of cases.
I
think that's right.
In line 16 and 17,
that's how I read that.
Great.
So that was my concern, is that the fees start to add up, and some of these folks kind of like squeezing it out of a tournament.
Right. The portion of subsection 1 is waivable, but it would be both imposed absent waiver on the.
And Madam Chair, is it still clear in the bill that the proceeds of the additional assessment are to be used for substance abuse treatment program?
I don't think anyone in this committee has a concern with that. I think the issue is, does this go down to Ways and Means, and do the folks who are addressing the treatment issues want to look at this as well? Okay. So,
and Madam Chair, I have
Senator
one question.
Senator Monson.
When doesn't the judge, if we give the judge discretion,
look at other ways of paying assessments through whatever community service, or if there truly is a financial problem, or, you know, I don't know enough about the court systems to know if that.
I don't know the answer to that question.
It's a trifle more complicated than that, but that's basically it. The judge has broad discretion to do quite a lot of altering of circumstances to make things work.
Yeah.
But on an individual basis.
Right.
It's an individualized approach as opposed to a general approach to the problem.
So, for example, follow-up manager, if you have the $1,500 assessment and you truly understand the circumstances of this particular person, that could be delivered, that assessment could be delivered in another way by the victim. Not the victim, but by the what do you call him?
Perpetrator. Criminal.
The criminal.
Felon.
The felon.
How about that?
Yes,
the felon. Alleged felon. So that
the convicted felon in this case.
Well, yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator. Chairman Brown, Senator Mons Anderson. Typically what happens is that the defense attorney will work with the prosecutor, and both will bring their concerns to the judge, and she or he will then make a determination as to what the best approach to that individual circumstances might be, given the resources available to address the problem in a very broad perspective, taking a very broad look at what resources are available. This would be a very small part of the exercise of the judge's discretion. There's usually a broad look that's given at that point. I think the discussion that we're having today is really how broad we want to make this bill in terms of its impact, and how much really should be left to the individual case. How much you want to legislate in terms of generally impacting the problem, and how much you think is better to leave to individual decisions in individual communities before individual judges in individual courtrooms. And that's really what we're talking about here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate your perspective.
Thank you.
So, besides, it's always fun to be asking the judge the questions. All right. On that happy note, we're going to close the public hearing on that bill. And I would like to move up to a public hearing on House Bill 2640, and maybe actually I'm just going to change that and go into work session. I don't want to move this bill today because the amendment isn't what I would like, but I don't know if anybody from the county clerks wants to come up and testify. But I think the concern, at least that I had with this bill, is that it prohibited electioneering within 100 feet of places designated for deposit of ballots or the elections offices. And my concern was that impacted potentially a lot of places. For example, I believe all of our local neighborhood libraries end up having drop boxes. So I was just concerned about free speech concerns, but also I'm not wanting to discourage folks from talking about politics in a positive manner in public libraries and that sort of area. So I just want to throw that out there, see if anybody has any suggestion. Does anybody else want to come up and come on up? We'd love to have you. And Mr. Wasson, you want to come up too, so it's great. Have you all up here.
Okay.
Go ahead, for the record.
Chair Brown, members of the Senate Rules Committee, I'm Nicole Williams. I'm the Clatsop County Clerk, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks.
And I'm Annette Newingham. I'm Lane County's election official, county clerk, and I'm also here on behalf of the city.
Okay. And Mr. Wasson, we'll get to you in just a minute. Okay. Do you two have any specific issues that you want to raise or concerns about my concerns? Or pushback, I guess, is what I'm looking for.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
okay.
I would like to address just a little bit more specifically, kind of a little bit compare back to poll elections for a minute. And the reason I want to bring it back to that is to kind of say that we used to have the 100 foot rule that dealt with all of our poll locations. And it was complaint driven. And what it did is, at least if there was something where a voter, where our concern is the voters that are within that 100 feet have a protection so that we have some right to be able to come in and help them in what they perceive to be harassment of some sort that keeps them from being able to do the act of voting. And so because we do all mail elections, a good deal, like for instance in Lane County, more than 50% of all the ballots in my county are now dropped off at my drop locations. Out of all the ballots that are returned, that's a good percentage of people that are going to these different locations throughout the county. And we have had complaints where people are saying, I went to drop off my ballot, and people are taking my ballot. I don't know that they're an election official, or they're giving me information that's not an election official that's giving me this information. And we don't go out there and patrol that any more than we did at the poll locations, but we do want to be able to have an opportunity to be able to take some action to protect those voters, and that was the intent. But it's certainly a policy decision that you would have to decide.
Thank you. Do you want to add anything? Okay. Mr. Watson, why don't we go to you, and then we'll go come back to the committee.
All right. My name is Greg Watson. I have degrees in political science, journalism, and law from the University of Oregon.
And we won't hold it against you.
I spent 15 years as a member of the Capitol Press Corps, and I spent much of the last 20 years thinking about, reading about, and writing about the initiative and referendum. While there is no federal right to an initiative, once Oregon decided to give initiative rights, it is responsible to confer them in a manner that is consistent with the federal constitution. Statutes that only, and the Supreme Court has ruled repeatedly that the right to initiative is equal to the right to vote in terms of First Amendment protections. Also, I took advantage of the extra half hour to go over and read the sites and read the cases cited, and my jump sites aren't accurate, although the cases are accurate. Although I'd be so arrogant as to think anyone's going to bother reading F-3rds. Statutes that only mildly restrict initiative rights must be related to a legitimate state purpose, while those that drastically restrict such rights must be narrowly drawn to achieve a compelling state interest. But in either case, statutes that restrict either level are only valid if they're necessary. And in terms of efficiency, for the same reasons that I oppose 2640. I also oppose the -12 amendments to 2082, which says you can't, only the signer can fill in the addresses. And so in terms of efficiency, I've addressed both things today. According to written testimony presented today by Dan Meek, HB 2640 would ban petitioning for almost 2 months outside of public libraries, meeting locations, and on public sidewalks that are within 100 feet of any entrance to the building where ballots can be deposited. What's worse, the people who bother to turn in their ballots are the people who really care about performing their civic duty and are most likely to care about initiatives and understand the importance of initiatives. Clearly, this bill is a drastic restriction on initiative rights. And I would just ask, what is the compelling state interest? In terms of the 2082 that would prohibit, I don't sign initiative petitions because I almost lost my arm to a truck and it, so my arm doesn't work very well. I didn't know that I could have someone fill in my address, so in the future I will do that. But in terms of what my signature, the state has only two legitimate interests, whether I am who I say I am and whether I want to put the issue involved in the initiative to a public vote. And by verifying my signature, the state can verify that I am who I say I am. And no matter who fills in my address, no matter who fills in my address, by looking at their address, the state can verify that I am who I say I am, and by verifying the signature, can verify that I want the issue put to a vote. And so, for that reason, I oppose both 2640 and the -12 amendments to 2082.
At least you're consistent. All right, questions from the committee? Sir, Chris?
Just a couple, and this may be confusing, but I'm a confusing guy. My first question, Madam Chair, is if you're allowed to apply for an absentee ballot by electronic mail, how do you verify signatures?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as far as an absentee, we check when it comes back in, because they sign it, mm-hmm. and that is the point where you actually validate, because that's their voted ballot, and we're checking the voted ballot against their voter registration, which is really more legitimate.
Okay.
And I have to tell you, Senator Cruz, they check everyone's signature. I had this happen to me. I got a call, and I can't remember, a few years ago, and poor Vicki Irwin was so embarrassed that they were that it was my signature, did it match, because my signature had changed over the years. And they call me in, and I had to go in and show them that I was who I was, and that was my new signature. So they do a really good job of checking signatures.
Which is another problem that I don't want to get into right now. But my other question is, when we're talking about a place designated for the deposit of ballots, if I put a stamp on the envelope and stick it in my mailbox, isn't that a place designated for deposit of ballots?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, no, I do not think that is, because we have to designate official drop sites, and mailboxes are not official drop sites.
Scary.
Yeah.
Well, it's a legitimate question, because that's a designated way to vote. I can put my ballot in my mailbox, and I assume that I have voted. Same as if I took it to a courthouse and stuck it in the box.
Madam Chair.
Senator Avakian.
I would guess that that's just a vehicle of delivery to the place where is the deposit.
Well, just
a thought.
If I can also further just clarify a little bit, is that a ballot is not, it has to be received. And the official drop boxes, when it's in the box, it's considered received by a county clerk, which is a difference between a U.S. Postal Service.
Uh-huh.
So I would like to clarify that.
That's really interesting. Okay. That's very interesting.
Postmarks do not count.
Okay. All right. Sir Ferrielli.
Does that include places not officially designated?
No. Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Ferrielli, yes, that does include places that are not official. Drop sites.
Okay, that's very interesting. Okay, well, we'll keep Sarah Montes Anderson.
Just a real quick question regarding the person, prohibits person other than an election official. It's only happened a couple of times, right at the 8 o'clock hour, and our drop site is at Gresham Library. And in order to have traffic control, you have to drive off the street and into the parking lot and around, and there would be someone there to collect, and I have no idea if that was an election official or someone from the library.
Mm. Madam Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, actually, that is a really good question. One of the things I can tell you, that in Lane County, we actually have election staff that do the collection. I would think that the other clerks also deputize whoever is doing the official collection. What we do want to keep away from is the fact that we have people who are just walking by the street and collecting ballots. And so we're trying to maintain that control within those 100 feet so that we do know that there aren't other people in the confusion that would be doing something different. That's important.
All right. I guess for the two of you, I guess we'd really like to sort of narrow this over the next couple of days, so any help you can provide us would be very useful. I do think Greg raises some really good arguments, and I am certainly concerned about the constitutional issues and the broadness of this. And I guess so the question I would just sort of ask you as we ponder this quickly is, have there been a number of complaints? Has this been an issue recently? And all that kind of stuff. So, and I'm smiling because all I could remember was Nicole Smith, and then I was thinking, well, I know where I got that one, and it's Williams, so I got that. So, I don't know if that's a good connection or not. So, anyway, we appreciate you joining us today, and we're going to close the work session on 2640, and let's hopefully bring this to closure quickly over the next week or so. Let's move into work session on 2762. I wanted to bring this back. Members had some concerns about it. I reviewed the bill. I talked to, or at least my staff talked to clerks. I believe that the way the bill is crafted and the current statutory scheme by using the office of the county clerk as a mailing address for purposes of registration, I feel very comfortable that our county clerks, your county clerk aside, are scrutinizing folks and making sure we don't have non-residents, non-citizens voting. So I feel very comfortable. I'd like to move forward on this bill. I know folks had concerns about, you know, is a motorhome a bus and, you know, do we move into antelope issues? But as I read the bill, clearly you have to go to the county clerk's office to pick up your ballot. It isn't like it's mailed to you on a bus or a motorhome. So I feel some comfort. I'd like to move forward on this. I know Senator Ferrielli hates it. So is that an understatement, Senator Ferrielli?
No, Madam, that I think is an accurate
statement. Okay. All right. So we are in workshop session. We do not have any amendments, and the chair would move the House Bill 2762 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Ferrielli, I summed it up pretty quickly. I'll just start stating your opinion, and we can move on. Would you please call the roll, Krista?
Senator Buckian.
Aye.
Senator Ferrielli.
No.
Senator Cruz.
No.
Senator Smith.
No.
Senator Montana.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Chair votes aye. Mary, would you be willing to carry the bill?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Sarah Montesano is going to carry the bill. We'll look forward to a very interesting floor discussion. Thank you. And then let's move back up to a public hearing on Senate Bill 1051. Did I get everything else?
Yes.
All right. Let's bring up, I know we have a number of folks signed up in opposition. Pretty clear signal. Let's bring in Mr. Minahan, Mr. DiLorenzo, anybody else testifying in favor of the bill?
Which one are we on?
Senate Bill 1051, the fireworks bill. And our timing is perfect, given that 4th of July is just around the corner.
Right.
And then I've got some neutrals.
I'm just going to do a public hearing. So, public hearing only, so you guys need to go this way.
Hi, welcome.
Hi there. Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent Oregon Pyrotechnics Association. The content of Senate Bill 1051 with the Dash 1 amendment before you is a product of collaboration. I met with many parties that had issues with the original draft, including Thousand Friends of Oregon, the State Fire Marshal's Office, FDC, John DiLorenzo, and many others. I can say nearly all of the issues and concerns that were brought to my attention have been addressed. I say nearly because I did not reach a full consensus on all issues. However, my clients did agree to such conditions, notifying local authorities, fire authorities, neighbors, conditional use permitting, limiting the storage to 400 square feet of non-farm prime land, and agreed to obtaining a wholesaler's permit from the State Fire Marshal's Office. Even though my clients do not sell fireworks, nor do they wholesale fireworks, my clients do. They put on the aerial fireworks display that we see on 4th of July and at the air shows around the state. Although we have done all we can do to address the many issues, there are still some who disagree that farmland should be used at, not used at all for the purpose of storing fireworks. There are two reasons why my clients and I disagree with them. The first being safety. Storing fireworks in rural areas is simply safer. The second is due to simple market fairness. My client's competitor operates on farmland and can make identical product at much cheaper cost, and my clients are forced to lease industrial land, given the buffers and the regulations, they really couldn't compete on a fair level. Now, with that being said, I want to be clear that everyone knows and my clients understand why that exception was made. It was made to save jobs and to limit impact on the environment. And we feel Senate Bill 1051 and with the Adash Amendment allows my clients to compete on a level playing field with minimizing impacts on the environment. In short, John and I and many others have worked very hard together to address these issues, the fairness issues, along with the environment issues. And I think we've come together with a pretty good bill.
Thank you. John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I represent Western Display Fireworks. Western Display Fireworks is one of the largest aerial display fireworks operations in the state. They're headquartered out of Canby. Several sessions ago, we obtained an exemption through Senate Bill 667 to be able to continue our employment in Canby. That was before Senator Farioli's committee at the time, the Land Use Committee. We were originally adverse to the proponents and were opposed to Senate Bill 772, but we have negotiated through a collaborative process significant changes, which are now reflected in Senate Bill 1051. There was one oversight from our final product that did not get picked up in the printed version of Senate Bill 1051, and that is the Dash 1 amendment that you have. The purpose of the Dash 1 amendment, since the bill requires the fire marshal to issue permits, the purpose of the Dash 1 amendment is to provide that one cannot store these items in the absence of such a permit. So that's basically what the amendment does. It was just an oversight from the bill. I would say that this is a consensus product as between my client and Mr. Minahan's people.
But unfortunately, there's a pile of people in the back of the room who are not very excited.
I would also say it is a collaborative product insofar as it reflects and deals with the concerns which were raised in discussions with the fire marshal, with DLCD, with the counties, and the fire districts. It does not reflect the concerns of the Farm Bureau because the Farm Bureau was just opposed to the bill and there was no way to reflect those concerns in the bill. But I want to compliment Mr. Minahan for his industry and his enthusiasm and his doggedness in getting to yes, especially with us. And
as so those of us who know you, John DiLorenzo, that's quite the feat. So.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time, and we are fine with this.
Questions for the panel? Seriously, we do appreciate you guys working hard to get on this and getting to yes. So, all right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Schlack, Schellenberg, and is it Johnson Rindy or Bob Rindy and Jim Johnson?
Both.
You all want to come up? Okay. I'm going to let you go take the gavel. We'll see if I can check in with Peter.
Oh, thank you. This hearing will be over in a flash. Pardon the pun. Flash bang.
Flash bang. That's pretty good.
It is good.
For Friday after
Friday.
Yeah.
Welcome. Please begin. Identify yourself. And
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I was a member of the, I'll call it the work group that met to discuss this matter. One of the issues, and I guess let me back up a minute. Each session, the legislature is brought forth a number of conditional uses to be placed either in a farm or forest zone. Usually you can find a nexus between the conditional uses or the uses that are brought forward. One of the problems that the Association of Oregon Counties has with this bill is finding the nexus between the storage of fireworks for displays at the 4th of July in an exclusive farm use zone. And we raised this question early on with the proponents of this bill. We also raised the question that in the rural areas of this state, there are a number of sites that are identified for rural industrial activity, also for rural commercial activity. The use of storage of fireworks in a rural industrial zone is either, in some instances based on the county, is either an outright permitted use with some criteria or a conditional use. So I would submit, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that there are ample sites around the state, and in the, especially in the Willamette Valley, of rural industrial sites where this type of activity could take place. And the proponents of this legislation has not, at least to my knowledge, been able to indicate other than, let's say, a level playing field in terms of the value of the land or the rent that might be charged, why they could not locate on sites that are rural industrial, already identified sites that I would submit to you, because they have, many of them are old mill sites and other kinds of sites that have been developed for industrial activity, have adequate access. They have water available to them, and they have fire protection that you might think of that, well, we know that would be extremely important. Mr. Chair, for those reasons, even though we have addressed some of the issues and this is now a conditional use rather than an outright permitted use, the Association of Oregon Counties cannot support the passage of Senate Bill 1051. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don Schoenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau, members of the committee. Agriculture is, excuse me, a significant and sustaining part of Oregon's economy. And in addition, we provide significant environmental benefits, including wildlife habitat and scenic views. Purpose of Goal 3 is to preserve agricultural land for agriculture production. That's the whole purpose. After 25 years of land use planning, well, more than that, but numerous legislative sessions, I'm beginning to believe it's now the not-so-exclusive farm use zone. When we began, there were seven permitted and conditional uses listed in the statutes. Today, there are 50. That's about an average of two new ones every legislative session. So we'd implore you that not to add one more that is unnecessary. In view of the fact that there are rural industrial zones, as Mr. Schlack just indicated, throughout Oregon, and all the other concerns that I've listed in my living color written testimony there, we don't see that it's necessary. If they are as safe as they indicate they are, and I don't have any reason to doubt that they're safe, I don't think that's the issue. And the issue in the bill, all the conditions and everything, that's not the issue that we're concerned about. But what I would challenge you to do is to cite one good reason why an explosive storage area should be cited in the farm zone instead of an industrial zone. And with that, I would ask your opposition to Senate Bill 1051. Thank you.
Questions for the panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Rindy. I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I've delivered to you today a letter written by my colleague, Ron Eber, who's our farm forest specialist. Unfortunately, Ron is on the road today and unable to be here, which leaves me to deliver this. I will say, warn you up front, I'm not generally an expert on EFU. Mr. Johnson is here from our sister agency and can probably answer more detailed questions. What the letter that Ron has written for you points out is that what you just heard, that every session we seem to get a longer and longer list of uses allowed in farm zones, and he's simply asking and that we not continue to do that, noting that we have a Big Look task force which is thoroughly reviewing the land use program and may be before your next session with major changes. I've also attached, or Ron attached to the letter, a letter from the governor making these same points, and so I'll bring that to your attention and stop there and be happy to answer questions.
Questions from the panel?
Chair Farioli, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I won't take a lot of time here. I am here to answer any questions that you may have on exclusive farm use zone, but I would just say that the points that the concerns that we have been made, the number of uses in a non-farm uses in a non-farm zone, and the lack of look for alternatives that are already available that can meet the same needs. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? I guess I would like to ask, what is the total number of exclusive farm use zoned acres in Oregon? Do we know that number?
Chair Farioli, we can get you that number, yes.
Well, I'd be interested to know, what is the total? And then also, it's my impression that the proposals that might come forth for the storage of fireworks would involve a relatively small number of acres. And I'd like to know from the department how many acres might be involved, by your estimation.
Chair Farioli, what I can tell you is that as it's written, it would preclude development on high-value farmland. So that would be, there's approximately 2 million acres of soils in the state that would be involved with that, what would be considered high-value farmland soils. However, I'd say 500,000 acres that or whatever are within non-farm zones or in forest zones, and so by definition are not considered high-value farmland. So it's going to be the vast majority of the exclusive farm use zoned land in the state is not high-value farmland. Mm.
Yes. I think that's a good clarification. I guess what I'm really interested in finding out is, are we talking about, one way to answer the question is that you could say potentially every agricultural acre in Oregon could become a storage facility for fireworks. But that would be a disingenuous answer. I'd like to know, you know, with some specificity, how much acreage would actually be affected by this legislation were it to pass. And if it's 10 acres, I want to know that. If it's 100, I want to know that. And I guess the question for me is, what percentage of these potential acres are we really looking at? How far out does the decimal point have to go? So, you know, please bring the information back.
Senator Farioli, I believe Ron Eber has those numbers at his fingertips. I apologize, I don't. I seem to recall that, and I've heard him say that it's around 16 million acres that's in EFU. If Mr. Johnson is right, then it would be about 14 million acres that would be eligible under this bill. The other number that I've heard is that it's around 1 million acres of land in the state that's been accepted from the farm standards, i.e., if we're looking at rural commercial industrial lands, there's some large amount of acreage that's available in rural areas away from population center that have already been accepted from agricultural land. I don't know the actual amount of that that's zoned industrial, and perhaps we can bring that back to you as well. I have heard, and this was on a work group that I was on last session, when you were considering a bill that opened up in rural industrial zones to more intensive uses, one of the things that we kept hearing was that a lot of the rural industrial acreage, land zoned for industrial in rural areas, it lies vacant or underutilized, and that was indeed one of the reasons behind that legislation last session. So I suspect that there is a large percentage of industrial acreage in the state that arguably could be available for this use, but again, I don't have exact acreages.
I think that would indicate to me that it's there, it's just in the wrong place.
Mr. Vice Chair, you may be correct. I think the point is that it is in rural areas. It's not in, often it's not in population areas.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Ma'am?
Thank you. I've always been pretty consistent regarding
not wanting to encroach upon our farmland, but I would like to know when you give us those figures, how much, what percentage of those EFU lands are high value farmland? And are, is the land that the, this, these fireworks would be located on, are the high value farmlands excluded or not?
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Mona Sanders-Anderson, the way I understand how the bill was written, these would be precluded from being cited on high-value farmland, so we'd be looking at only the lands that are not high-value farmland. I would caution you that a determination of high-value farmland under the definition in state statute is not just a determination based on soils. It's a determination based on the predominance of soils on any given tract, so we're not going to be able to give you an exact number because the determination is made on a tract-by-tract basis. So a 50-acre parcel that has 24 acres of high-value farmland on it is not high-value farmland because it is predominantly not composed of high-value soils. Mm-hmm. And so there's without a database that shows us the ownership statewide, which isn't out there, it's hard for us to calculate exactly how much there is. We can tell you how many acres of the soils there are, and so that can get you into the ballpark. But I can show you a lot of examples both directions where something that has a lot of high-value farmland is not high-value farmland because it's got a large part of non-soils on it, and something that's got a lot of poor soil on it still becomes high-value farmland because it has predominant high-value soils on it. So it works both ways.
No.
Further questions? Thank you. Anita Phillips, Donna Dish.
And we have a deal on the water coins bill. Everybody's happy.
Let's go.
A few minor tweaks.
Good afternoon and welcome. Thanks for joining us on a sunny Friday afternoon.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Anita Phillips. I'm the licensing manager with the State Fire Marshal's Office. And with me is Donna Dish, our senior policy analyst. We just want to let you know that while our position on this bill has been neutral, we wanted to commend all parties involved for being able to work together to get this bill to where it is now. This bill actually has satisfied the concerns that the State Fire Marshal's Office had, which is the safety for those we regulate, the first responders and our citizens. That was our primary concern, and with these amendments, we feel that our concerns have been addressed.
Okay.
If you have any questions of us, we'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. And Chair Brown and members of the committee, I'm Donna Dish, as Anita said, but I think, she, you know, in the interest of time, let's just stick with what Anita said, and I'll be here for questions as well.
Great. These two pick on cues quickly. Questions?
Looks like you guys are off the hook. Appreciate you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1051? All right. We're going to close the public hearing on 1051. Need to talk with folks that have a higher are on a higher pay scale than I do to see what the future of this bill holds. And obviously, if it's going to move, it'll probably be scheduled next week. So we'll keep you posted. Anything else to come before the committee? Everyone travel safely. I think it's going to be a fabulous weekend, and I hope you enjoy it.
And where, Madam Chair?
Well, I think I'm going to John Day Prairie City.
Yeah. Take your wallet, spend some money.
Are you staying here in Salem?
I am.
Lucky dog. All right. Thank you all very much, and be back on Monday, and please remember we're going to be on 1 hour notice, and we may be scheduling this at pretty short notice, and we'll try and work with committee members' schedule as much as possible, but it may be that it's more important to get the session done than for you to have an appointment.
Yeah,
so thank you. Did I say we're adjourned? We're adjourned.